Now, detonate the reality bomb!
Jesus Christ, you're a man.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapults of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The Western world took one of the biggest steps toward global government this past week, and many of us, frankly, didn't even notice. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is an expert on the technocracy movement. He's been tracking it and chronicling it for a long while. He's the author of some very important books, co-author of the books Trilaterals Over Washington, Volumes 1 and Volume 2, a book that I recommend every opportunity I get, Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. And he just formed a new website, publisher of a news site portal that keeps you up to date on what's happening around the world as far as developments leading toward a global government, especially through creeping technocracy, and that is technocracy.news. It is our honor to welcome back to the program Patrick Wood. Pat, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, you're entirely welcome. Good to be back with you.
Well, announcement was kind of low key, I guess, for most folks like me who were kind of caught up in the National League playoffs. I've been a Chicago Cubs fan since I was a child. I think they do a blood test when you're born on the north side, like I was, and so you know it's you can't help
it. But
there was an announcement this week that is pretty significant, and I just feel we ought to explore this and really understand how significant this announcement was, and that was the disclosure by the federal government that negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this trade pact that the Obama administration has been working on for quite some time, has been finalized, and now it moves to the next phase, whatever that is. What is the Trans-Pacific Partnership? What happens next, and why should we even care?
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a trade agreement that's been negotiated amongst 12 nations in the Pacific Rim. We are one of those nations, of course. And the idea from the negotiator's point of view is to wrap all of these countries into a new economic regulatory structure that would regulate global trade. It isn't so much about trade itself. It's about the regulatory process that will be employed to do global trade. And right behind it, we have to realize, too, there's a transatlantic partnership being negotiated at the same time with Atlantic countries that will cover the other 60% of gross domestic product in the world. The TPP covers about 40% of GDP, and the TTIP will cover about the other 60%, roughly. And between these two treaties, what they're hoping to do, well, not just hoping, they are doing, they're harmonizing regulations amongst all of these different countries and elevating the control over trade to a global body. In other words, the nation states will be diminished, greatly diminished, and control over the regulatory mechanism will be given to a global, the global system, if you will. And that's what it's all about. It is huge, absolutely huge. Your listeners, if they remember from some of our previous conversations, will remember some of my talk about the Trilateral Commission and how they intended to create a new international economic order when they first started in 1973. And they might recollect that most of the U.S. trade representatives over the years have been members of the Trilateral Commission. The current USTR, Michael Froman, is just incidentally a member of the Trilateral Commission. He's the chief negotiator of the TPP and the TTIP. Coming up soon. So this is like, if you can go back and picture the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is called NAFTA, That was orchestrated by a member of the Trilateral Commission as well. Her name was Carla A. Hills. She was working for George W. Bush at the time. And you remember that Ross Perot said if they passed NAFTA back then, you'd hear this giant sucking sound going south.
Exactly right.
And that's what happened. Of course, we heard giant sucking sound going south, going east, going west. Mm-hmm. About the only place it didn't go was north into Canada. But America got pretty well gutted because of NAFTA. Well, just imagine NAFTA on steroids now, even beyond that, with TTP, with the TPP agreement and the TTIP coming on for the Atlantic nations. It's just unbelievable what these people have done right under our nose. And I have to say, while everybody has been looking for a political coup of some kind, you know, they're all concerned about, well, what about, we need to get a different president, we need to get this, that, you know, politicians. I just have to say, folks, right while you're concerned with all that stuff, there's been an economic coup of tectonic, absolutely tectonic magnitude, right under our noses while very few people are watching. I've been watching it, hopping up and down for a long time, almost 40 years now, Derek. So, I don't know when I get to retire from this. I think never. But
so this is.
But I don't care. At this point, I don't care. I'm fighting for my kids and grandkids at this point, right. And they're, you know, the following generations, whatever, if we last that long.
So this is not the kind of thing where electing the right president, whether you know, Trump or Rand Paul or somebody like that, this isn't going to make any difference.
It will not make a hill of beans worth of difference, I'm afraid. The stakes are higher than anybody believes. And I'll tell you, there's no flavor or even a whisper of conspiracy theory here. So if anybody's thinking, oh, this is one of those guys, forget it. All we've ever done over 40 years is merely take what these other people have written, and we simply reported it verbatim. That's all we've done for all this period of time. And listen, the head of climate change at the United Nations, Christiana Figueres, she had a press release or a press conference earlier this year in Europe, in early February, and here's what she said. Openly, this is on the internet. It's on the United Nations website. Anybody can go there and read this. I recommend they do. But here's what she said. This is the first time in the history of mankind that we're setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution. Close quote. Now, you don't hear this mainstream news, Derek.
No.
This is what they're doing. This is what they're doing right under our nose. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is 100% complicit with the United Nations to scuttle free enterprise and capitalism as we know it today and substitute in its place sustainable development or green economy, a green economic system, they call it, based on resources, resource scarcity and allocation, altogether different from what we've enjoyed in this country for over 200 years.
This sounds like the carbon-based currency that you and I have talked about before. Is that what this is leading to?
It is. There's more chatter. There's more global chatter on energy currency today than ever before in the years that I've been studying it. It's just incredible. They keep talking about it on forums. They're having conferences on it. 2 years ago, there was a conference in Croatia called Energy Currency, and it was attended by economists from all over the world. They're talking about it. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Talk about the handwriting being on the wall. You know, Figueres also said in that same she knows what she's talking about here. This is not a slip of the tongue, a double slip of the tongue. She also said, and this is a quote, she said, "This is probably the most difficult task we have ever given ourselves. which is to intentionally transform the economic development model for the first time in human history. They get it. Hmm. They understand what's going on. And, you know, I've talked to people that, you know, have actually said, well, but, you know, transform, come on. It just means that we're going to add a little green flavor. We're going to, you know, we're going to start buying more efficient light bulbs and stuff, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I say, look, let's go to the dictionary and let's look at what the word transform means. What does transformation mean? Can you trust the dictionary? Quit being sloppy with the language, for Pete's sake. Transformation is defined as a thorough or dramatic change in form or appearance. Synonyms include metamorphosis, transfiguration, sea change, reconstruction, and morphing. Now, she knows the English language just fine.
Yeah.
And they choose to use this word everywhere you look. Transformation, transformation, transformation. You'll see the phrase deep transformation all over their literature as well.
So the
so they know what they know the score. They know what they're doing. And even worse, she says we have a timetable.
Hmm.
Wouldn't you like to see that calendar?
Well, would I be too far off if I guessed that this has something to do with the agenda, the 2030 agenda that they were discussing at the United Nations last week?
Bingo. That's on the timeline for sure.
Wow.
It was so important that even Pope Francis himself came to address the United Nations. He didn't come here to speak to Congress. He didn't come here to speak to Obama. They invited him to come here to New York to speak to the United Nations, and all the rest of his visits were just ancillary to the United Nations meeting.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. The United Nations meeting. Now, was this the Sustainable Development Conference
That's right.
Okay. And
that's exactly right.
Now, for those who, this was a real flaw of mine when I was in outside sales. It usually took multiple repetitions to remember stuff, which was bad because you have to remember a lot of names and faces. Sustainable development, as it is defined by those in the movement, what do they mean when they say sustainability or sustainable development?
Well, certainly it is an economic term, right? What they mean, and I'll just define it through the eyes of this meeting that they call it. It was the 2030 Agenda Conference. What they intend to do, and it's very clear in their documents, they intend to create an economic system that promotes sustainable production and sustainable consumption. They never say straight out exactly how they're going to do that. But they promise us if we go along with them, that the net effect will be it'll eradicate poverty throughout the world. It'll provide jobs with dignity for everybody in the world. and it will eradicate disease, and it will provide lifelong learning opportunities for everyone. Now, okay, yeah, this is a carrot, you know. This is the sugar coating right on the poison pill. But down in the document that all the nations of the world signed on to on September 25th of this year at this meeting, down in the bottom of it, the countries committed to radical changes in their infrastructure and in their economic systems to allow for sustainable production and consumption processes. And Derek, I have to tell you, if you look, and you know this, you look back in history at all the different movements, whether it be socialist or communist or fascist, the big argument in every one of those isms or whatever was always about the control over production and consumption.
Mm-hmm.
In every case, Marxism was about production and consumption itself. This is not Marxism, however, but the debate is over the same major subject. Who's going to control production and consumption?
Right.
They don't intend it to be you and me. Let's say that you had an inkling that somebody needed a better mousetrap, and you had an idea that you think you can do, like you could make something or whatever, and you think you could produce a product that people would want to buy. And let's say you go down and you just rent a little storage facility and you start making these things, and you find there's a market. People go, wow, I never thought of that. That's great. I want one of those. Well, you might even build yourself a little business, you know. You might buy more inputs, whatever, lumber or whatever it takes, metal takes to make the thing. And you might even hire some people and give them jobs to make your product and sell it to people who decided voluntarily they want to buy your product. This is called free enterprise. This is the way the world works. We have a gajillion choices of products today to choose from because we have a free market. Some products don't make it. Some companies go out of business. That's the way it goes. If you make a bad bet, you're going to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
But we live with that, and we enjoy that kind of system. In a sustainable development system, decisions will be made as to what will be made and what will be consumed. So if you went to the Bureau of whatever, production, and said, I have an idea, and I'd like to get a permit for making my blah, 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 and I need so much input for this. I need some metal. I need some lumber. I need some dirt, whatever it is. And they would review your application to produce. And if it didn't fit their guidelines, you'd get a letter back in the mail says, don't give up your day job just yet.
Mm-hmm.
and you would be denied. You're not going to produce that because we decided that it is simply just not needed in relation to the amount of resources that it will consume.
Hmm.
And so on the flip side of it, if you decide that you want to consume certain things, like, and I'm not accusing you of anything at all here, don't get me wrong, but let's say you like to drive a gas-guzzling SUV. And you have the money to buy one, and you go down to the lot, and you see a pretty green one there sitting on the lot, maybe a big GMC, whatever.
Yeah, Government Motors, sure, one of those. Yeah.
And you say, man, I want to buy that car. And you say, well, it only costs you whatever, $1,000. They say, here's the money. Thank you. Here's the car. You go home. You're happy as can be. And, of course, the person that sold the car is happy as can be. And the person that manufactured the car is happy as can be. And everybody's happy. You had choices. You could do what you want. The sustainable development crowd wants to tell you that you can't buy that kind of car. It consumes too much gasoline. It has your carbon footprint is too high. You need to cut. You need to quit being selfish in the rest of the world. You need to cut back your carbon footprint. You need to start driving a little car that gets 40 miles to the gallon, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you need to start using less water. You got way too much grass in your yard. You got a half acre of grass. Shame on you. You need to have maybe the allotment is maybe an eighth of an acre of grass. So get rid of some of that grass. And you've been flying all over the place, taking pleasure trips and going here and there and to Europe, and you went somewhere else. And why? You're flying too much, and that increases your carbon footprint too. So we're going to cut back on your flying allocation, and you're only going to get allocated one trip a year.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, but wait a minute, don't I have choices here? And they say, no, you don't. People living in cities right now are being told and being forced out of their cars in favor of some kind of mass transit or just riding bicycles. What if you don't want to ride a bicycle? Well, it's too bad. This is what we offer. And mm-hmm. This is what we need to have a sustainable world. And cities need to, you need just to get around on bicycles and have walking paths. This is happening all over the country right now, by the way, under these general plans and stuff the cities are implementing. They're cutting out whole streets and they're turning them into walking and biking zones. And you wonder, well, what's this all about? Well, it's about the sustainable crowd that got into your community, and they're changing your behavior and your patterns. They're denying your choices. They're denying, your limits to your access to stuff and saying, you want to get into that area, you're going to have to park your car and walk. Or you're going to have to park your car and take some kind of shuttle in or a light rail, or maybe you're going to ride your bicycle in from home.
Huh. Now, this kind of central planning requires a lot of data, a lot of information. One of the things that I've been tracking and looking at and just kind of making notes on over the past few years is the intrusiveness of and we're complicit in this because we're choosing to use all of these connected devices that are feeding information to the cloud, the internet, insurance companies that are offering discounts if you let them plug a device into your car.
Yes.
To report back to the insurance company how much you drive and how you drive, how fast you drive, and things of that nature. How do these technocrats hope to get the information they need to make these kind of decisions? Or maybe I should ask it this way. How are we seeing this drive for this information, this desire to get all this information, manifest itself in our daily lives?
You know, the production of information is nothing new. We did less of it 30 years ago than we do now, but we've always had information. We've always had private papers and you know, phone calls we made to people, whatever. There's been information associated with every person's life. The question is, what happens when people steal your information without your consent and use it for nefarious purposes to turn around and try and control you with it? That's the problem. The information is not the evil part. Like, for instance, the iPhone is not the evil part. The fact that the iPhone might have location services in it is not the evil part. The evil part is that there are people collecting that data without your knowledge, or most of the time without your knowledge or consent. They're collecting that data in order to do nefarious things to you and to society at large. And this is not, you know, the cell phone is just one small little thing. But when you consider that the total awareness society right now is providing data on all your financial transactions, like all everything you buy, everything you do, it's got all of your Obamacare and your health data fed into it. It's got all of your Common Core education data fed into it, because students now have 400 points of data that's being collected multiple times a year on students from pre-K all the way through college, and it's going to stay with you the rest of your life. You know, every email that you send, every phone call that you make is being recorded, transcribed, and stored in a master database, all connected to you. Now, the fact that this information was generated in the first place is not evil. The fact that it's being collected by a group of people, which I solidly believe are these technocrats, they're collecting this data in order to engineer society according to their precious scientific method. This is absolutely insane. And, you know, I would read to you what technocracy was defined as back in 1938. This is what the Technocrat magazine said technocracy was, and it's just beautiful. They said, and I quote, "Technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population," close quote. That's their goal. It's a machine. It's a giant manufacturing machine, the whole thing. That's why they're collecting the data. They have to have more data. There's never enough data that they can get collected in order to run this giant economic machine, and not just in our country, all throughout the world. This is being done everywhere. They're collecting data everywhere. In fact, other countries have been complaining about even our collecting data on them.
Yeah.
They don't have a clue. These are the politicians saying it. They don't have a clue that the technocrats are talking to each other in these different countries, and they're laughing their heads off at the politicians and how far behind the curve they are. I know they're saying there, if they only knew what they're doing, they'd have a fit. They don't have a clue, man. You know, we're way ahead of them. They don't understand what's going on. But you know, this is a huge part of it. And yeah, I don't know if we did this before on last time we talked, but the technocracy study course that was written in 1934, mostly by M. King Hubbard, it listed in it seven requirements to make technocracy happen. And I'll tell you, you got to hand it to engineers. They know how to document a project. You just give an engineer a good project, and he'll get his he'd get his quadro paper out and his ruler and his, you know, slide rule, whatever, and he'd go to town on it just to figure out that project.
Yeah.
That's what they did in 1934 with the technocracy study course. And they said, look, there's seven things you need to do in order to make technocracy a reality. Here's the first five. Okay. They're very short. I'll just read them. Number one, quote, register on a continuous 24-hour-per-day basis the total net conversion of energy. Number two, quote, by means of the registration of energy converted and consumed, make possible a balanced load, close quote. Now, those first two are the blueprint for smart grid, the control over energy.
Right, right.
It's just as clear could be. This could have been written 10 years ago. This could have been written 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfect. That's what you need. Here's number three. Quote, provide a continuous inventory of all production and consumption. Number four, quote, provide a specific registration of the type, kind, etc. of all goods and services where produced and where used.
Wow.
Number five, quote, provide specific registration of the consumption of each individual plus a record and description of the individual, close quote.
Wow.
Now, does that just answer your question?
That's creepy. That's like living in, I mean, that's Orwellian.
Well, you know what? That's why Orwell wrote his book. He was looking at technocracy. Huh. That's why Huxley wrote Brave New World. You know, technocracy was at Columbia University in 1932. That was a big wig thing for them to be there. They were riding high on the hog, so to speak. That's what we say out in the hinterland, right? High on the hog.
Yeah.
They were just on the top of the world at that point, and Aldous Huxley caught wind of this. And in 1932, the very same year when it was making a big splash, he got inspiration to write Brave New World.
Hmm.
Now, nobody knows that because he don't know about technocracy. Folks, this is where it came from. He was looking at technocracy when he wrote Brave New World, and he immediately concluded, scientific dictatorship straight ahead. That was it. It was micromanagement over every facet of life. They were engineering babies in incubators. They were grooming people to be, you know, to either be real smart or real dumb or whatever, to fill all the various positions and, you know, in society that needed to keep society. It was completely engineered society, just like the magazine Technocrat said in 1938. Mm. That's exactly what Brave New World was. It's exactly what 1984 is, from a different angle, but both of them are totalitarian.
It is
so.
It is ultimately dehumanizing because it eliminates the free expression of individuality.
Oh yes,
personal choice. It is soul crushing.
It is soul crushing. Hmm. You're absolutely right. I like that term. I think I'll adopt that.
I wish I could claim its original.
It is soul-crushing.
And that's why, you know, coming back to Pope Francis and his appearance at the United Nations and the 2030 Agenda Conference, for looking at what is ultimately a Luciferian agenda, because it is attempting to create a utopian world through our own actions, and we know that we're not going to see heaven and earth until Christ returns, why Pope Francis would... Am I misreading this? It appeared to me that he was throwing in with this idea.
Well, he threw in long before that, actually. He's been talking about climate change all year long.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of June, I believe, or maybe just the 1st of July, he released his long-awaited encyclical on climate change. Now, an encyclical is not official church I heard from God doctrine.
Right. It's not a papal bull, in other words. Yeah.
It's not a papal bull, that's right. But an encyclical is hugely influential. It gets distributed to all the bishops in the world, and they're expected to take heed to it, not just ignore it and throw it in the trash can. And so the encyclical on climate change was a scathing rebuke against the existing system of the world. in favor of producing this system, this economic system of sustainable development. That's, and he, and it was just effusive. And he was, he fully intended, even when he created the encyclical, he fully intended to appear at the United Nations to present his encyclical to the world, to the non-Catholic world, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. He did. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he did. So by doing so, you can argue his motives for, you know, why he's going to throw in, and people are spinning various conspiracy ideas around it too. I just uniformly reject them all. But for whatever his reason he's coming in, it doesn't really matter. The fact is that he has thrown in with them.
Hmm.
And, you know, he's backing sustainable development 100%. But let me make a distinction here for you and for listeners between climate change. We're kind of talking about climate change on one hand, and we're talking about sustainable development on the other. I don't want people to think that they're the same thing, because they're not at all. But here's the strategy. Sustainable development is the goal. That's the economic system.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change is not an economic system at all.
No.
It's just a hodgepodge of bad science and a lot of fear-mongering by people like Al Gore to drive us towards sustainable development. So it's a good cop, bad cop kind of a scenario. We're going to be the bad cop and scare the pants off of you with theories about climate warming. The seas are going to rise. Millions of people are going to be drowned or displaced.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Can't run to high ground. But, you know, this is the thing. Oh, the world's going to change. The continents are going to cook. And, you know, the sea's going to rise. All the ice is going to melt. It's going to screw up the weather. The whole world's going to be upside down. And listen, brother, the only possible chance you have to take care of and mitigate climate change is to jump on board with sustainable development. That's the pitch.
Hmm.
So sustainable development is nothing more than a tool to drive people towards sustainable development. Does that make sense?
Yeah, if you can convince enough people that their very survival is threatened unless they fundamentally change the way they live, you know, change the way they get to work and back, change the career, change their home entertainment, you know, change the way they heat their homes or how high they heat their homes in the wintertime, things like that, you know, the world is going to die. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yep. Well,
from the standpoint of selling it. Now, there are those who will defend the Pope and say, well, you know, what's wrong with being good stewards of God's creation? Isn't that what we're called to do?
Oh, yeah, I'm on board with that.
Sure.
You know, I grew up on a farm, and we were concerned with that every day.
Farmers are the greenest parents, people I know.
Yeah, my parents took care of the farm. They took care of the land. They loved the land that they farmed, and they never consciously made a bad decision to harm anything through any practice or any event when they were farmers. And that was the culture that I remember growing up. So, you know, these people can't tell me anything about conserving, you know, being kind to Mother Earth or whatever. That's ridiculous. Go ask a farmer, for Pete's sake, if mm-hmm. he knows anything about the earth. These people that are spouting these doctrines have probably never even been outside of New York City.
No, and that would tend to...
They don't have a clue what they're talking about.
And that would tend to shape your worldview.
They're leading the blind.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, yeah. But on the other hand, yes, there is a... this is the argument. Well, why wouldn't you want a nice environment? Don't you like to breathe clean air? You know, I mean, you get all this kind of backhanded arguments, and you have to say yes. It's kind of like asking somebody, Derek, have you stopped beating your wife yet? Now, you see, you can't answer that question. If you say yes, oh, how much did you beat her?
Yeah.
And if you said no, oh, you're still beating her, are you?
Exactly, right.
it's how you make the statement. It really is. But this is what this climate change is. They're so clever about how they've you know, stated all this stuff. People get tied up in knots before they can even say what's really on their mind. And, you know, but once you look through the facade and you kind of get past all that flack, you realize this stuff is just dark-hearted, as dark could possibly be.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, demonic is a nice term for it. Well, that's almost a compliment. It's so bad.
And again, that begs the question, though, why would, and Pope Francis isn't the only religious leader around the world to voice his support for addressing the climate change issue, because a number of denominational leaders piled on after his encyclical was released to say, yeah, us too. What possible end, what goal could any religious leader, not just Pope Francis, but any religious leader have for saying, yes, well, yeah, this is something we need
to look at? Let's look at the scope of green religion right now. It didn't just start with the Pope's encyclical. It goes back quite a ways to the looking back to the interfaith movement. There was an interfaith summit on climate change in 2014, for instance.
Hmm.
An interfaith, that was what it was called, the Interfaith Summit on Climate Change. Now, there's something, you know, you'd like to be a fly on the wall at that one.
Yeah.
After that conference was concluded, the World Council of Churches issued a press release. And this is what they said in that press release. I'm not reading the whole thing. I'll just read what interests us here. They said, they wrote, and I quote, "There has never been such a large amount of religious environmental activity in one location in the history of the world. This week will mark a watershed in the history of religion. It will be a time that people remember as the time when the world's faiths declared themselves irrevocably as green faiths."
Huh.
Close quote.
Interesting.
Isn't that mind-blowing? It's just, you know, I mean, I don't watch the Catholics or the Presbyterians or the Episcopalians or the Church of Christ or whatever. I just don't watch those. So I don't pay attention to them. Mm-hmm. I attend a small, you know, non-denominational church out here, and we're just not concerned with those things. So I don't pay attention to them. But I read this, and my teeth about fell out. I knew the World Council of Churches was, you know, I had no use for them at all, and necessarily the denominations either. But I read this, and my teeth fell out of my mouth. So holy mackerel. So I wasn't too surprised when the Pope starts talking in January, big time, about his climate change encyclical. He wants to race to the top of the pack. Mm-hmm. The rest of the world's religions were leaving him in the dust. A good Pope can't let that happen. I'm saying that facetiously.
Sure, yeah.
You know, I mean, what kind of Pope are you, man? You're leading from behind, are you?
Huh.
You know, so what's a Pope to do? He creates a major encyclical on climate change.
Yeah.
And you know what's even worse, Derek? You know who he enlisted?
Well,
I can't pronounce the guy's name. He's German.
A fellow named Johann or John Schnellenhuber.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Don't ask me to say that. I can't say it. Even when you said it right, I still can't say it. But yes, this guy's an atheist and he's a pantheist.
Yeah.
It's like, excuse me?
And he believes that we have
What's the Pope doing hiring a pantheist to be a major contributor to his encyclical?
Well, the thing that was disturbing, and I will say this, in the Pope's defense, he did at least in the encyclical say that the global population has no impact on climate change. But that is not Professor Schnellenhuber's position. He thinks we've got 6 billion people too many on planet Earth.
I know. Exactly.
So, you know, who gets to decide? That's the big question.
Of course. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And that ultimately.
And so, of course, is sustainable development as a doctrine does very much preach that there's too many people on the planet and the population needs to be significantly reduced.
Mm-hmm.
They just never say how.
Yeah. And again, who gets to decide? That is always the big question. Coming back around to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because, you know, folks that we live near here in the Ozarks hear about this and say, well, you know, this is a trade agreement. You know, we don't, you know, I just raise cattle here, sell my milk in the market or to the dairy up in Springfield, and this isn't going to affect me. I'm looking at your technocracy.news website, though, the article that you posted on the 5th of October, comparing and contrasting in a very handy form NAFTA versus CAFTA versus the Trans-Pacific Partnership and another agreement in here, and all the check marks that coincide with these elements of the trade agreement seem to do more than just deal with trade. For example, parties shall implement obligations under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Okay, I guess you don't want to traffic in rare big cats or something across. Commitments on control of marine pollution, commitments on control of ozone depleting substances, commitments on fisheries management, commitments on natural protected areas. So wait a minute, we're giving this Trans-Pacific Partnership authority here in the United States to force our compliance with those sorts of non-trade things?
That's right.
Huh.
That's right. Most of these requirements, by the way, I'll tell you where they're coming from. They're coming out of the a document called the Global Biodiversity Assessment. It's a 1,200-page boat anchor that was produced as a result of Agenda 21 back in 1992. And all of these issues pretty much came straight out of that. I'm just telling you that because I happen to know that. But you're absolutely right. You know, what this is all about, what sustainable development is all about in a big sense is the grabbing of resources of the earth away from people and ultimately away from nations. It's a power grab for resources. And, you know, I'll say that we could discuss this in a biblical sense too, that wealth has always been equated to resources, stuff that comes out of the land.
Mm-hmm.
You got a gold mine, you got a cattle, you know, you got raised camels, whatever. I mean, you're a farmer, you got oil wells or whatever. All wealth in the world stems from the earth, from the resources in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
This has historically been the case. If you have $1 million or $1 billion or $1 trillion in a bank, you're temporarily fat on cash. But don't think you're wealthy, because you're not wealthy. You're still a pauper because you have no resources. These people understand, from the Rockefeller crowd on out, they understand that ultimately whoever controls the resources controls everything. That's how it was during the Dark Ages, remember?
Yeah, when you
controlled everything, and then everybody else just had to eke out a living and squat on a corner of the landlord's property and hope they didn't get thrown off.
This is we're returning almost to a feudal system, a 21st century feudal system.
That's exactly what it is. It's gonna look like a scientific dictatorship on one hand, where the people are micromanaged on those properties, and otherwise. You will not have access to any resources unless it's been granted to you by the powers above you, by the system, if you will. If it determines you're good enough to have anything, well, you might get some of it. But, you know, I'll tell you, it's like, let's say you wanted to drill an oil well down the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Say maybe somebody died, a rich uncle died, and you know he had an uncle, he died. Says, I'm leaving you $10 million. You go, whoa, $10 million? I could go down and, I could drill an oil well in the Gulf of Mexico for $5 million and invest in a tanker to carry it everywhere and sell it. I'd be set for life. And so you go down and you apply for a drilling permit from the U.S. of A. government that has control of all that waters and all the mineral rights. And you fill out your application and you put it in and they say, my name's Derek and I want to drill a well. And I got money to do it. You show them the cash on the table, and they're going to look at your application and laugh their fool heads off and say, "Get out of here, you idiot! You know we got Shell Oil is coming in, or BP's coming in tomorrow, to buy up a 500,000 track, acre track of, get out of here, you little wimp."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you could forget drilling a well. Well, see. When somebody owns whoever owns the resources makes the rules. That's just that simple.
Well, how does the Trans-Pacific Partnership enforce this sort of global control of us at the local level?
by usurping authority. I can give you a perfect example of this. This won't take long. In 2002, the U.S. Congress passed a law requiring labeling on certain food products, especially beef products, in America. This was by the will of the people, by the way. Okay, mm-hmm. We passed legislation here. It's called Country of Origin Labeling. Okay, that's cool. COOL, mm-hmm. Country of Origin Labeling. Now, that's a good thing. Consumers said, we want to know where our meat comes from.
Right.
And it was other products as well. I'm just using meat as an example. We want to know where our meat comes from because we don't want mad cow disease. Now, that's reasonable. We're a free country. We make that kind of rule. Okay, we made a law. Congress passed a law stating that, beef manufacturers in America, processors, packagers, so on, they need to declare on the packages where the meat came from. Canada, Australia, America, whatever. Well, last year, Canada went to the World Trade Organization and sued meat packers for their cool labeling. They said, you'll laugh at this. I know you won't. Maybe you will. They said, this is an unfair advantage because people in your market, in America, in other words, people in the lower 50, why, they tend to be discriminatory against our Canadian beef. You see?
Yeah,
this was the actual complaint, Derek. And let me tell you what happened. They won at the World Trade Organization, and the World Trade Organization turned around and demanded that the meat packers drop their country of origin labeling. Ooh. And it got tested in court, and you know what? They did, and today you will not find out where your meat comes from.
Wow.
Now, for any American that understands what just happened and what I said, if that doesn't make your blood boil, I cannot imagine what would. Maybe you're just already close to death. I don't know. But so basically, this is like, what? They overrode our Congress, our own established law? They overrode it?
Yeah.
Yes, they did. That's because the World Trade Organization already had control over some of these things. Now the Trans-Pacific Partnership is coming in, and it's going to give them everything, Derek, lock, stock, and barrel. Everything of an economic nature is being turned over to these same global tribunals that are full of unelected, unaccountable technocrats and bureaucrats who can do anything they want to do from outside our border. And we have to basically say, well, how high do we have to jump, sir?
So, in other words, another company, say, in a pharmaceutical industry, could file a lawsuit, you know, say an Austrian pharmaceutical company decides it's not being treated fairly inside the United States. Well, Austria, that's not Trans-Pacific, but to say Vietnamese decides it's being treated unfairly. It can appeal to or take a case before a TPP tribunal.
Yes.
Staffed, as I understand it, by attorneys that are essentially trial attorneys who normally represent corporations. They would rule on this, and that ruling would supersede American law.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Now, President Obama is looking at this as one of the key achievements of his administration. What chance does Congress have of saying, you know, this is really a bad idea. We're not going to pass this. I mean, as I understand my Constitution, although it certainly didn't work out with the Iranian nuclear deal, the United States Senate is supposed to pass any treaty, has to approve it by a two-thirds majority. Now, somehow the Republicans in Congress managed to roll over on that one and just said, well, we'll just vote yes or no. And then, you know, Mr. President, you can veto it, which means we'll have to get two-thirds to vote against you. So they lowered the bar essentially to one-third of the Senate from two-thirds. What happens with the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Will the Senate have to approve this? How close is this to becoming reality?
they do have to approve it. And the process to do it at this point is using so-called fast-track authority.
Oh.
This was originally defined in 1974 as the trade promotion authority. And what it's been expired for many times, and it's been reinitiated, and currently, just I don't know, it's a couple months ago, there's a big battle in Congress, and you're right, the Republicans mostly drove it through, and so the president currently has fast track authority active, and what that means is when he sends a letter to Congress declaring that the TPP is coming at him. And he hasn't done that yet, but he's just right on the edge of it. He'll do it any day now. When Congress gets that letter, Congress has 90 days to do everything necessary for the president says, I intend to sign this. They have 90 days to pass it. It has to be passed on an up or down vote. No amendments are allowed. No changes to language. Nothing. It's take it all or nothing. So the stakes are high. And secondly, they only get a certain number of hours for public floor discussion, which greatly limits the amount of debate that would normally be held. And thirdly, it lowers the threshold of passage from 2/3 to 1/2. So they need 50% vote instead of 2/3 vote for a normal treaty. And of course, you can get 50% vote accumulated on just about anything you throw at Congress these days, one way or another.
Yeah.
By the time the deal makers are done with you, and by the time the compromisers are done with you, and the blackmailers, and anybody else that has to come to the floor to convince you to vote for a particular issue, they can always get 50% vote for something. And that's all they need to do for TPP. And right now, I would say it's almost 100% certain that they're going to do it. The only thing that may prevent them from doing it is if the American people raise up against the Senate, especially.
Yeah, and I'm looking at this.
You do this, we're gonna march on your offices, and we're gonna keep coming until we're all the way inside of your offices, and we will crowd you out for the next 100 days or whatever.
But
it's gonna.
The thing that's disturbed me in looking at this and doing some research on this today is that there's some trade organizations out there that are influential in the part of the country I live in, the Ozarks. For example, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association says Congress should ratify the TPP. The U.S. Grains Council CEO said it would increase the output of grain exports from the U.S. by 11%. National Corn Growers were hopeful this agreement continues the tradition of past free trade agreements, which have had a positive impact for America's farmers. National Pork Producers Council, Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement will help ensure that U.S. pork products will be competitive in Asian markets and so on and so forth. It doesn't sound like the trade organizations that are advising rural America have any problem with this. Frankly, I don't think most people in the cities pay enough attention to know what's going on. Where would this opposition come from, and how do people get educated about it, Pat?
Well, the people listen to this program are getting educated. And,
hope so.
The people that we're talking to on media and radio and stuff around the country right now, they're getting educated. And hopefully by the time the vote actually comes up, there's going to be, quite a bit more activity. There is a great organization that I worked with for several years in Washington, D.C. The name of the organization is a Coalition for a Prosperous America, CPA for short. And CPA has been fighting bad trade deals. They're very experienced people, very credible group now. They've been around now for, I think, 7 or 8 years. And I was fortunate enough to have been involved in the organizational meeting that they had back at the very beginning. And I've been with them ever since. They've done a super job. And they're calling on senators and congressmen on a daily basis to educate them on what this stuff is all about. And they almost got to the point where they tipped the fast track vote. But there were some last minute deals made, compromises like we just talked about. And they got enough votes to pass the fast track authority to the president. But the fight is not over. And I know there's probably a couple of other organizations like CPA back in Washington that are also on the same track. But they've been fighting this now consistently, and they have a really good footprint in Washington. People know them. They can get into places where other people might not. So, it's not like it's a complete vacuum, But, you know, groups like CPA and stuff, they need money. You know, they don't have any grants. They don't have any George Soros or anything like that backing them. Every nickel that they've used in their efforts and stuff have been coming from local businesses and people in America. And you wouldn't believe, I wouldn't divulge any information, but you wouldn't believe how many businesses, corporations in America that are American corporations that do get it.
Mm-hmm.
They really get it. And they say, man, we got to stop this. Some of these companies are putting up thousands and thousands of dollars to allow them to do these education projects in Washington, D.C. And so the farmers out there, like in Indiana and the Dakotas and so on that are supporting TPP, I have to say, I mean, I know some of them. And I just have to say quite bluntly, they're idiots.
Hmm.
They're just blithering idiots. They really don't understand what's going on. And I come out of a farming background. I farmed actually myself for several years. And I know a lot of farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the same thing to them. I've had discussions where, you know, basically all they're doing today is learning, is figuring out how to live off the government land bank and how to juggle loans and how to meet this requirement and that requirement and whatever. They don't know how to farm anymore. All they really know how to do is to work the system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like professional people on welfare or, you know, welfare professionals, they call them, right? They know how to work the system. So their work is working the system.
Yeah.
And I've challenged farmers, said, what are you doing? You know, you're sitting here 8 hours a day gaming the system and you're not spending any time farming and doing the things that, you know, we used to do in this area to build up the community, to build up our farms, to build up our land and stuff. You're spending all your time gaming the system and you've just ceased to be a farmer. And they just look at you with, you know, their eyes glaze over.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure.
Well,
I'm not too happy with the farming community. You can tell.
Yeah, I gather. And it's a shame because that used to be the backbone of American society 100 years ago. Well, maybe more, a little more than that. But prior to the turn of the 20th century, America was, for the most part, a rural nation, and farming was its backbone. And that is no longer the case.
It is not.
Mm.
It's very sad.
Yeah.
It's a very sad state of affairs.
Well, again.
I'll just say politics make odd bedfellows as far as TPP is concerned. It used to be that Republicans opposed this kind of stuff and Democrats were for it. Today, Democrats are almost universally against TPP and Fast Track, and Republicans are the one that's pushing it.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is bizarre. And the odd thing is that the progressives who supported this president and put him into power to do certain things like, you know, end the war and eliminate the influence of Wall Street in the White House got exactly the opposite.
I know.
Yeah. Well, you know, the older I get, the more I realize we really are living in a kind of 1984. But thankfully, you know, the Lord saw all this coming. And we know that ultimately someday, as he told or as we know through the Apostle Paul, vengeance is his and he will repay. It's just,
that's,
you know,
right.
We just wish he would operate on a more human time scale, like now, you know.
I know.
Patrick Wood is the author of Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. And if you don't have a copy yet, you should get one because it is excellent. It basically spells out what the technocracy movement is, the philosophy, the worldview in which it is rooted. And then spend some time at the end of the book on the good news, which is the prophecy of his return. And that is what we are all hoping for sooner rather than later. And if you want to keep up with news about the technocratic movement and how it's manifesting in our world, his new website is an excellent resource, technocracy.news. And Patrick, we appreciate your work on this and appreciate you taking time out of your schedule today to talk with us about this.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. You're entirely welcome. I always look forward to an opportunity to speak to an audience and somebody like yourself who I've known for a number of years as well. You know, this is the easier group that I ever have to talk to for sure.
Well, I appreciate that, but it's always an education. For more from Patrick Wood as he tracks the technocracy movement and the Trilateral Commission, their activities and influences on our world today, you'll find links in the show notes to his websites, including the new Technocracy News website. The show notes, always posted at vftb.net. View from the bunker, vftb.net. net. And if you don't have a copy of Technocracy Rising, Patrick's book, you really need to get one. And I don't say this as somebody who's getting a kickback or because I'm just trying to help him out, but because it really is an excellent resource. He documents the growth of the movement, not just historically, but also goes to the philosophical, the worldview underpinning the technocratic movement, which I recognized while reading the book was exactly the way I'd been schooled. Okay. And understand that I started in school in the late 60s, you know, kindergarten, 1967. So 60s and 70s. So this is, you know, 45, 50 years old now that this movement has basically infused and informed our public education system. So we've got a couple of generations of us who, without even realizing it, are biased against, first of all, against a supernatural worldview, and biased toward natural explanations for the problems that face us. And sometimes technology and political activism can cure some of the ills that face our societies. But ultimately, when you get right down to it, what the root cause of poverty in the world, as Jesus said 2,000 years ago, he said, you know, they will always be with you. It's not because he was a pessimist, but because he knew the condition of the human heart. The problem is not capitalism. I've got some very good friends who would disagree with me on that statement, but the problem is not capitalism. The problem is the human heart. Okay, if there weren't people in the capitalist system who weren't trying to enrich themselves at the expense of others by gaming the system, by breaking the law, it wouldn't be a problem. You know, I mentioned, I believe in the previous program, how in my freshman year of college, we read the Communist Manifesto, and I thought, wow, this guy, you know, these guys, Engels and Marx, they really, you know, nailed some of these problems affecting the capitalist system. And then I read their solution, and I was like, no, wait a minute. If the problem is that those in power tend to consolidate their power, how does that not apply to a socialist system or a communitarian system? They don't have a solution for that because they didn't allow for God. They didn't allow for the supernatural. They were blinded by their own prejudices, as most of us are to some degree. We see now in part, you know, as through a glass darkly, as the Apostle Paul wrote. But that is the issue. And it surprises me when somebody like Pope Francis lends support to the technocratic movement in calling for global control over issues related to climate change, because as Patrick points out, that affects when you get down right down to energy usage, you know, carbon currency, you can use that climate change to basically control every aspect of human life. And somebody like better than almost anyone else on earth, Pope Francis should know that the problem is not capitalism. The problem is the human heart, sin. So, but anyway, it was prophesied, and I have no doubt that the Lord understands better than we do what's going to happen. And just observably over the last couple of centuries, we see that this experiment in here in America keeps moving back toward the middle. And of course, the middle ground of human history has been serfs serving the lords, a royalty. And we seem to be moving back in that direction. I mean, the fact that we've got another Bush and another Clinton running for president in the United States is all the evidence that we need. Speaking of climate change, however, just want to toss out one interesting story, because this people who believe in climate change, in anthropocentric climate change or global warming, the belief that humans are responsible for the planet warming up, their worldview is based on less evidence than those of us who believe that a carpenter from a dusty backwater province of the Roman Empire rose from the dead 2,000 years ago. A leading climate change expert used to serve in the climate change office, the greenhouse office for Australia, Dr. David Evans, who's got 6 degrees in applied mathematics, went back to the model that's used for most of these gloom and doom climate predictions and found a couple of very basic fundamental errors in the mathematics. Gee, I wonder if those were just accidents. So he corrected the accidents and reran the numbers and found that temperatures, which most observers, even those who believe in anthropocentric global warming, admit, have stabilized over the last 20 years. There has been no global warming for the last couple decades. Said the temperatures will remain flat globally until 2017, and then they will begin to drop. And by the year 2030, we'll be in a mini ice age. He says fundamental flaws in how future temperatures may rise have been included in the standard models, and this has led to inflated mathematical and therefore temperature predictions. He said there's an intellectual standoff in climate change. Skeptics point to empirical evidence that disagrees with the climate models. As I mentioned, the fact that observable temperatures have not risen for 20 years across the planet. And yet climate scientists insist that their models are correct, even though we can see that the models have failed to predict what's happened for the last 20 years. He says when you actually go into the mathematics, the effect of carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas is maybe 10 to 20% of what the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicts. Farmers are pretty smart. Farmers will tell you, you know, their opinion of carbon dioxide. It's plant food. So, anyway, this probably will not change things. Again, the fact that Antarctic sea ice is at a 30-year high, the fact that temperatures have not risen, observably have not risen for 20 years, and now a couple of fundamental errors in the IPCC's model, the standard models used to predict future global warming, probably will not change things. I doubt that we'll see Pope Francis retract his encyclical on climate change from earlier this year. But wouldn't it be ironic? The United Nations, its big meetings addressed by Pope Francis for its 2030 agenda. And by the time we get to 2030, we may be in rather instead of the polar ice caps melting, we could see Wisconsin, Minnesota, then the Dakotas under a glacier. Now, I'm just making that part up. I don't know that for sure. Other quick news, a tragic terrorist bombing in Ankara over the weekend. This is Turkey. About 100 people killed, a couple hundred wounded. And analysts at this point, as of Monday morning, really don't know who's responsible. One terrorism expert from Georgetown University saying it's like Casablanca, Humphrey Bogart's Casablanca, the usual suspects with a range of possible motives. Possible suspects include the PKK, which is a Kurdish group that's been fighting kind of a long-running, simmering civil war against Turkey, and ISIS, some pointing their fingers at the Islamic State, which would be ironic if true because there's substantial evidence that the government of President Erdogan in Turkey has been supporting ISIS under the table, off the books, if you will, as kind of a junkyard dog to accomplish what they want, which is to eliminate the pro-Shia government in Syria as a step toward reestablishing the caliphate, which, of course, you know, the Ottoman Empire was based out of Turkey for hundreds and hundreds of years. So uncertainty over who carried it out will make it difficult to figure out how the Turks will respond to this. But needless to say, things are getting really, really interesting and not in a good way in that part of the world. And one other little complication that deserves a mention, an oil exploration company says it's discovered significant quantities of oil in the Golan Heights. Aphek Oil and Gas, which is an Israeli subsidiary of the U.S. company Genie Energy, spelled G-E-N-I-E, like the one that comes out of the bottle, which we would know as a demon, has said that this is a huge discovery. Most strata in which they find oil, rock strata, run about 30 meters, 20 to 30 meters thick. That's 40 to 60 feet thick. The strata that they found is about 1,000 feet thick, 350 meters thick. And they said it's not only thick, but also the porosity is very conducive to oil production. Was there an estimate on the number of barrels here? I think we're talking in the billions of barrels potentially. Now, the reason this is significant, first of all, if it's as big as they say it is, experts say it could provide all of Israel's energy needs. But secondly, why this is important, because the rest of the world recognizes the Golan Heights as part of Syria and not Israel. So, could this potentially change the face of the Middle East? Yeah. Love of money is the root of all evil. And if the quantity of oil underneath the Golan Heights is as significant as they think, it could be a game changer there. Interesting coincidence. The Golan Heights is part of Bashan, which is the ancient kingdom of Og that Moses and the Israelites faced back in the book of Exodus. Bashan was the last of one of the Rephaim giants. Bashan, the area that was known as the abode of the Rephaim, even by the neighboring cultures, the Syrian culture, the Ugarits, or Ugarit was the, I think you pronounce it, the Ugaritic, or, yeah, whatever. The Ugaritic culture knew that Bashan was known as the gate, basically where you found the gateways to the underworld, the gates to hell, essentially. And Mount Hermon, where the Watchers came to earth and corrupted mankind. Also in Bashan, the Golan Heights. Very, very interesting. The Gilbert House Fellowship took a week off this week. I did some traveling. I actually spent the weekend with our daughter in St. Louis. The Chicago Cubs were there. And the very first time in the history of the National League, which dates back to just after the Civil War, that the Cubs and the Cardinals have ever played in a playoff game. So we had to go and wear our Cubs regalia around a bunch of Cardinals fans and take abuse. But the Cubs won 6-3, so that was okay. But because of the travel, we just didn't feel enough prep time for a proper study on Sunday morning. But we will resume the Gilbert House Fellowship this coming Sunday morning, as we'll post a one-hour verse-by-verse study. We're continuing through the book of Deuteronomy, and again, that shall be posted this Sunday morning, God willing, usually mid to late morning. Skywatch TV, tomorrow night, Tuesday night, October the 13th, another interview with Timothy Alberino and Steve Quayle, their discussion of their documentary series, True Legends, Technology of the Fallen, focusing on pre-flood technology and what appears to be a concerted effort by the Vatican to hide what they know about that technology. That will air on the Christian Television Network tomorrow night, Tuesday, 8:30 p.m. Central Time, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's UTC-5 if you want to watch it on the internet stream. The Christian Television Network streams its programming at ctnonline.com. That's ctnonline.com. We appreciate your reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you find a view from the bunker. And if you're on Facebook and you've noticed that we closed the PID Radio Cafe, the Facebook page for A View from the Bunker is still open. And you can swing by there, give us a like, and comment on the programs. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.